Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The House Book by Susan Greenwood, narrated by Marion Hussey. Prologue, 17th July, 1669, West Sussex. Banging on the door wakens her from a deep sleep.
Mistress needs you. Come quickly.
Still groggy and barefoot, she shivers a little in the chill night air, reaches for her shawl, and opens the door.
Come,
the master says. He takes her arm and leads her to the back stairs. It's the wrong way, and she hesitates. There's movement behind her, but before she can see, a hand clamps down firmly over her mouth, forcing her head back as her feet are swept from underneath her.
Get her out quick,
she hears him say. The shawl falls from her shoulders as she bucks and squirms and claws at the forearm tight across her throat. Down the stairs, out through the kitchen door, and into the yard they go. She still can't see her attackers. The master grabs a handful of her hair, winds it round his fist and brings his face so close that she can smell the spirit on his breath and feel the spray on her face as he spits out the words.
There'll be no more mischief in this house, mark my words. This is where it ends.
He turns to the men holding her.
Put her in.
And takes the reins whilst the others haul her into the back of the cart. Landing heavily on damp sacks, she is winded, and they gag her before she has the chance to scream. Two men hold her down as the cart makes slow progress across the farmyard and past the cottages, only picking up pace as it enters the lane. Gradually, her eyes become accustomed to the dark, and she can see the men's faces. She does not know them. The one tying her feet together is young, probably no more than 18, and is thick-set with long, greasy hair. He smiles slyly, showing a row of rotten teeth as he runs his hands up her legs.
She's pretty, though, isn't she, Pa? It'll be a shame if we can't take advantage, like.
The older man, a fatter, greasier version of the boy, is straddling her, holding her hands above her head.
Just come over here, son, and tie your hands, will you? She's bucking like a bleeding mule.
She can feel him getting hard, and he starts to grind himself against her. The boy now has her hands. The father pulls up her nightdress and moans as he fondles her breasts, then quickly clutches her buttocks and pushes himself against her one more time before rolling off and roughly covering her up again. He laughs and wipes the saliva from his mouth with the back of his hand.
Aye, it's a shame, all right, lad.
And he nods toward the back of the man driving.
But he's a pious bastard, this one, and whatever he's going to do with her, I can tell you now there'll be no fun of that sort.
He hands his boy a flask.
Here, have some of this.
The abuse she can easily bear. It inflames her anger but comes as no shock. The ways of men are no mystery to her, but the madness she saw in the master's eyes terrifies her. She rolls onto her side, away from the two men, draws up her knees, and tries to quell the rising panic. Three men rise from their campfire by the river as the cart bowls into view. They nod to the master, who brings the horse to a halt, and orders father and son to lift their captive from the cart. The older man is quick to size up the situation, and he places her gently on the ground. Their eyes meet, hers silently begging for help as she sees the apprehension in his and notes the change in him. He wasn't told about this, and he draws his boy away, shaking his head as the master approaches.
If you don't have the stomach for this, Coulson, you can leave us. You've done your bit and been well paid.
And the master turns his back on them. Her scream comes out as a muffled sob. She loses her balance, struggling against her bonds, and falls sideways amid jeers from the other three men. Her last little bit of hope disappears as she watches Coulson and his son walking away, and she finally gives way to tears. The master hands round a flask, and all four men take a long pull, ignoring the sobbing woman on the ground. Pocketing the empty flask, he walks over to the fire, lights a torch, and kneels beside her, holding the torch so close to her head that she can smell her hair burning.
You know why you're here.
He ignores her shaking head and continues.
You have performed malicious deeds using witchcraft. We will prove what you are.
And he nods to the other three. He takes no part in what follows, but opens another flask and watches closely. One man cuts the nightdress from her, then holds the torch whilst the other two roll her over and over in the dirt, rough hands exploring every part of her body, looking for a third teat. A scar on her side is suggested as evidence that one has been removed.
Inconclusive.
The master remains impassive.
Only one thing will prove it now.
And he tosses them a hank of rope.
Get her ready.
Blind panic grips her as they untie her feet and hands to rearrange them in the prescribed manner for ducking. Right hand to left foot, and left hand to right foot. Head pounding, heart hammering away. Energy floods through her body and she kicks and punches, tears away the gag and bites the nearest hand. The blow to her face is hard and swift, and the master's boot on her throat puts paid to any fight left in her. The ground shifts beneath her, faces blur and voices fade as her world slips into blessed black. She comes around to find herself still on solid ground. A horse is prancing on the spot only yards in front of her. Its nostrils are huge, flashing bright red in the half-light, and its body steams and quivers from being ridden too hard. There is shouting, and a new voice that she recognizes but can't put a name to until he covers her with his cloak and wipes the hair from her bruised and battered face. She sees the surprise on his face. He was expecting someone else. Walking quickly back to the master, he knocks the flask out of his hand and shakes him by the arm, trying to bring back his senses.
Good God, man, what have you done? Has the drink made you lose your mind?
The master glares at him, wrenches his arm away and points.
That woman is a witch, and we'll deal with her. You shall not, sir.
He reaches into his saddlebag and approaches the other three men.
I don't know where you're from, but this is my parish and my jurisdiction, and I do not hold with such barbarity. Be on your way and quick about it.
There is no arguing with the flintlock. The men pick up their belongings, tip their hats to the master, who hasn't yet shifted his gaze from the newcomer, and move off. The master does not move. He watches silently as the woman's bonds are cut, and she is helped unsteadily to her feet, remaining unmoved by the sight of her injuries in the lightning sky. She approaches him alone, holding the cloak close to her body, and speaks with a voice barely louder than a whisper. If I were who you say I am, I would curse you now. I would swear that neither you nor any of your blood will ever live long enough to find peace in that house. She takes a step closer and leans forward, looking up into his eyes and forcing him to look at her. That is. And she wipes the blood dripping from a cut lip. If I were who you think I am, think on that. 1. Oakwood Grange, West Sussex, May 1985. Tom Kelly was in his bedroom, selecting a clean handkerchief from the linen press, when he heard a car pull up on the gravel sweep outside his front gate. He crossed to the window, recognized the flashy car and its equally flashy driver straight away, and pursed his lips. The stupid boy had come without an appointment, and he'd brought someone with him. Well, he wasn't going to let them in. Bloody cheek. Why don't people have any manners these days? He stepped away from the window and waited for the sound of the doorbell so that he could ignore it. It didn't come. He went back for another look, but there was no sign of them. Looking through the side window, he found them by the five-barred gate to the drive. The shorter man was waving his arms around, doubtless spouting the usual estate agent's spiel, while the other man was leaning on the gate, one foot on the bottom rail, nodding, smiling, and taking it all in. Tom eased himself onto the window seat, picked up his bird-watching binoculars, and peered through the crack between the wall and the curtain. The agent, Ludovic, was over 6 feet, Tom knew, but the stranger was a fair bit taller and well-built, with longish, wavy dark hair brushed back from a prominent widow's peak, and his face was, he supposed, handsome enough. He couldn't tell his age. Everyone seemed young to him. The men continued to chat for several minutes more, patently at ease in each other's company, as Tom watched the taller man closely until his arms grew tired. He put down the binoculars and sat, lost in thought, before shifting his gaze to his wife's photo on his bedside table. Another look through the window, and his decision was made. He took the stairs as quickly as his knees would allow and headed for the back door. But by the time he reached the drive, he heard the car pulling away.
"Well, what do you think?"
Ludo's driving style was as flamboyant as his car and his fashion sense, and his inability to watch the road and talk at the same time was making Rob nervous. His right foot twitched for the brake.
"Relax, I know every twist and turn in these roads."
Ludo slapped Rob on his thigh.
"Oh, come on, what do you think?"
"I think," said Rob, hesitating, "that in a world where all your wishes come true, the house is perfect."
"Okay, well, that's a good start. And the but is?"
"The buts, Ludo, there are several."
And Rob indicated on his fingers.
"One, we can't afford it. Two, it's too big. Three, it's probably a money pit. And four, it's not really commutable. Oh, and until today we weren't even house hunting."
"Rob, Rob, you're speaking with your sensible head on. You're an artist, for goodness sake. What does your heart say? Anyway, don't answer that until I've had my say. First off, you don't know the price, and I'm not going to tell you yet, but I know it's negotiable. Also, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised by how much your London place has gone up in the last 4 years. Secondly, it's not as big as it looks. Believe me, it's 3 receptions, 4 beds and 3 baths by the time you've knocked it about a bit."
"What was point three?"
"Ah, yes, the money pit. You will have to spend money on it because it's dated inside, but I'll be surprised if there's anything major. Tom Kelly's a very proper sort who's always looked after the place. Did you notice the roof? Reslated only 2 years ago. Believe me, it's far from a wreck. What was point four?"
"The impossible commute."
"Yes, okay, I concede that's not great. 20 minutes to a mainline station and then 40 to 50 minutes on the train. But were we not discussing lifestyles over lunch in the pub?"
"We were."
Rob smiled.
"And did you not say how you and your wife were tired of London and wanted to move out? Fresh air, kids, animals, garden, the whole bit?"
"I did, but not this far out. Incidentally, we don't have any children. We're still hopeful, though."
"Oh, sorry, I mean, I just assumed."
Ludo slapped himself on the forehead.
"Foot in mouth, I do it all the time."
"Oh, really, forget it. We have a niece and nephew and umpteen godchildren between us, so we're not short of kids' company."
"Good. So I've just thought of something else."
Ludo pulled up outside his office, wrenched on the handbrake, and turned to face Rob.
"You couldn't see it from the gate, but there's an old dairy and milking shed that Tom uses just for storage, I think. But it'd make a great studio. 3 or 4 roof lights, et voila. No more lobbing out for expensive London premises. Why do you have to work in London anyway? Believe me, it could work."
Rob laughed.
"You've said believe me at least 4 times, Ludo. Is believe me I'm an estate agent any better than believe me I'm a lawyer?"
Ludo straightened his tie and tried to look affronted.
"Bloody cheek. I'll have you know I'm known for my fair play and integrity. Ask anyone. Look, I know I'm being pushy, but it's not because I need the sale. Heaven knows, I've got more business than I can handle at the moment, and believe me."
He grinned ruefully.
"That place is a good buy and could be stunning. I've known the house all my life, and unless I was sure it was worth it, I wouldn't be showing it to a mate of Guy's who's doing me a favour."
"I agree. It's a beautiful property, and I even believe you when you say it's not a money pit. But it's been on the market for how long?"
"Ages. But there's a good reason for that, and I can't go into it now. I've just realised I'm late for my next appointment. They're probably in there waiting."
And he nodded towards his office. Climbing out of Ludo's car, they shook hands, and Rob promised to be down again in about a week or so when he had some preliminary stuff to show him. Back in his own car, Rob sat for a while and drummed his fingers on the steering wheel. Then he pulled away from the curb and found himself driving back to Oakwood Grange for another look. The very idea that he might now be in a position to buy a house in the country made him smile. 5 years ago, things had been very different. It had taken his first big row with Janey to turn things around.
Why won't you do it?
No sooner had he put the phone down than she was on the attack, hands on hips, brown eyes wide and eyebrows raised. Always a bad sign.
It's wall dressing.
If she'd only arrived 5 minutes later, Rob thought, there would have been no need for all this.
Does it matter?
Yes, it matters.
Why?
Because I didn't spend 4 years studying graphic design at art college to produce rubbish for a 20-year-old rock star to stick over his fireplace in his stockbroker belt mock Tudor mansion, that's why.
Well, pardon me, Pablo.
Janey rarely smoked, but she snatched up one of his cigarettes, lit it, and puffed furiously.
Anyway, waving her cigarette at him, apart from the fact that your canvases are far from rubbish, you're not exactly overrun with design jobs at the moment.
Ignoring his glare, she carried on.
This is paid work, Rob, and if this rubbish is appreciated by someone, it's art, isn't it?
You can stop right there, Janey, because we are not going to have an argument about what is art. I'm going to make myself a sandwich. Do you want anything?
Janey shook her head, and he got up and went to the corner of his flat that served as the kitchen. As a tactic to silence her, it didn't work. Janey followed him and watched as he placed great slabs of cheese between two thick slices of bread.
I don't think Guy and Tash think their canvas is rubbish. In fact, didn't you say Tash remodeled the flat around?
She didn't get any further. Rob slammed the knife down on the counter, making her jump, and turned to face her, muscles in his jaw tightening.
That was different. It was what Guy wanted, and it was a small price to pay for 4 years rent-free accommodation. You know that.
But you also did one for the gallery, Guy.
Again, it was a favour. He's a mate of Tash's, and I felt I couldn't refuse.
Janey stubbed out her cigarette.
Well, he obviously didn't have the same scruples, paying you peanuts and flogging it for over 1,000.
All right, I see, said Rob, picking up his sandwich and moving back to the sofa. Not only am I too proud to churn out populist rubbish and shit at securing graphic design jobs, but I've also got a lot to learn about business. Well, thanks, Janey. That's cheered me up no end.
Janey ran a hand through her hair.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean it to sound like that. I just...
But he wasn't listening.
And another thing, career advice from someone who's never even had a job interview in her life and is about to be handed a ready-made business is a bit hard to swallow.
Janey stood there, staring at him, and blinking rapidly.
Oh, that's low, Rob. Really?
And she tailed off.
Look. Rob, immediately contrite, patted the sofa next to him. Come here and let me explain.
Janey sat down reluctantly, arms folded.
I have a good life, with no real money worries. I love working with Guy. His landscaping business is really taking off. He pays me well and makes sure we always have time off to play rugby.
He tried, but failed to charm her with a dimple-flashing grin before ploughing on.
I know the current design jobs are tiddle-assed and poorly paid, but I'm not desperate enough to take on stuff like this that I really don't want to do.
They sat in silence for a while, not looking at each other, until Rob brushed a fall of thick, fair hair from her face and tilted her chin towards him.
Does it bother you that I'm now more of a labourer than an artist? Is that what all this is about? Or are you worried about what your father thinks?
Janey pulled her head away from him.
You are such an ass sometimes.
She was so cross she had to stand up to put some distance between them.
It's got nothing to do with my father. What it's about is you. On the one hand, being satisfied with your single bloke's life, and on the other, saying you want us to live together. It's about you being 32 and asking yourself where you see yourself in a few years' time. Still working for Guy? Or doing something you trained for? It's about you and me, and building something for our future, if we have one.
She turned away from him. Stupidly, she could feel her eyes beginning to well up, and she didn't want to play that card.
Janey, darling.
He reached for her hand and pulled her back to the sofa where he rocked her gently, and she buried her face in his jumper. He couldn't remember the last time she'd cried. The seconds ticked away. Rob made a decision.
Right, do you know what?
I'll take that bloody job if it makes you feel better, but only if he accepts the ludicrously ridiculous price I'm going to quote him."
He stroked her hair again and kissed her forehead.
"See, I'll make a businessman yet."
Janie hooked her legs over his and, still not looking at him, squeezed him tight.
"I do love you, Janie."
There was a muffled response from his jumper.
"But this is all new to me. I've never felt this way about anyone before. I'll get there. I promise."
"I know." She wrapped her arms round his neck and kissed him. The forgotten sandwich was eventually shared, sealing the deal. "And just so you know," Janie, wiping the crumbs from her jumper, "I did have a job interview once, for a Saturday job at Topshop when I was 16. The 20-year-old rock star turned out to be one Johnny Williams, a 26-year-old biochemist from Wales who had abandoned his PhD at Imperial College when his band's first single raced up the charts. His Cheney Walk flat was a far cry from stockbroker Mock Tudor, and the finished 6x3-foot abstract sat beautifully over the new Conran sofa. He paid up happily. Nice though it was to have money in the bank, the real payoff came 2 months later, when the band's agent rang to say that Johnny wanted Rob to design Taliesin's second album cover and sleeve notes. Rob was on his way, and so pleased that he even forgave Janie for being smug. 2. Wandsworth, London, May 1985. "Hello, handsome." Janie reached up to pull him down to her level and kissed him. Rob hung up his jacket and followed her down the hall to the kitchen.
"Whatever it is, smells wonderful."
Then, noticing the flowers and candles,
"Bugger, I've forgotten something, haven't I?"
"No, but we are celebrating." Janie turned to face him and held her arms wide. "You are now looking at the sole owner of Mallory's Literary Agency, or I will be when Pupka retires at the end of the month."
"Hey."
Rob picked her up and swung her around.
"Congratulations. Although, as he's never there now and doesn't know what's going on, I don't suppose much will change."
True, but the proud Russian in him probably felt it difficult to let go completely. In fact, at that very moment, Anthony Mallory was setting off for a Mediterranean cruise without a care in the world. Eugenie, always Eugenie to him, never Janie, knew far more about the young literary scene than he. She'd become a keen negotiator and had a talent for signing good clients. Proud he may be, but not stupid. His time was over, and he wasn't even sad about it.
"It's funny. I never think of your dad as Russian. He's so very, very English. I can't imagine him as Anton Malchikov."
"He changed it for business reasons, of course. Malchikov's literary agency might not have gone down so well in the 1940s.
His mother was furious, though."
Rob chuckled.
"What?" "I was just thinking. Eugenie Malchikova sounds, you know."
He cocked an eyebrow and pursed his lips. "What, sexier than Janie Mallory? Well, I'm stuck with plain old Janie Whittaker now, although for a treat on your birthday I could do the accent, if you're good." She chucked him under the chin, thrust the wine bottle into his chest, and went to get the glasses. Rob poured and made the toast.
"To my little business genius, and the continuing success of Mallory's. It's good to know that, if my business falls flat, I can always rely on you to keep me in the manner to which I've become accustomed."
"That's funny, now you're so busy. I was thinking the same thing." He quickly showered and changed, and was back in the kitchen, peering over her shoulder as Janie put the finishing touches to their first course, mushrooms in garlic and parsley.
"A starter as well. Did you come home early?"
"Oh, hilarious." She made a face. "I can't be brilliant at everything. Get me those plates, will you? It's ready now." They were well into the chicken casserole and a second bottle of wine when Janie said, "So, tell me about your away day down in deepest Sussex. Was it that mate of Guy's you were going to see?"
"Yeah, he's an estate agent in Petworth. God, it's lovely down there. He took me to lunch at a fabulous little pub. It turns out it's not far from where your grandparents used to live."
"No, really?
I wonder if it's changed much.
I doubt it. Time seems to have stood still down there.
Rob got up to clear away the dinner plates.
Anyway, this chap Ludo.
Ludo? Janie scoffed. As in, I play?
No, smart ass. It's short for Ludovic.
And Rob smiled to himself, wondering how best to describe him.
Ludo is your typical hunting, shooting and fishing type of ex-public schoolboy.
Janie looked heavenwards.
He's inherited the agency from his father, much like you, and has great plans, just like you. And he has no intention of remaining a provincial outfit. He's going to set up a swanky country house office to rival the big London boys, and he needs a whole new image. That's where I come in. New name, new logo, new signage, new brochures and adverts, the lot. And he wants it done quickly. We tossed around a few ideas, and I said I'll get the roughs over to him in the next week or two.
Great. But you haven't got time to do that now, have you? I thought you were under pressure to get the mock-ups for the museum posters done this week.
Yeah, well, I think I'm going to hand it over to Gilly after I've fully briefed her. It's time she showed me what she can really do. It'll be a great opportunity for her.
Janie dropped a fancy box of chocolates on the table in front of Rob. Dessert. I couldn't stretch to three courses. You open them and I'll put the coffee on. Rob picked up the box, turned it over a few times and put it down again, unopened.
I hadn't appreciated, you know, just how beautiful it is down there, until today.
Oh, I know. I love it.
He followed her to the counter, wrapped his arms around her, and whispered in her ear.
How would you like to live there, then?
Janie looked at him over her shoulder and laughed.
Yeah, right. How would we manage that, then?
I have a plan.
And he told her.
You're mad!
I prefer brave and far-sighted. Promise me, you'll come with me next time I go to see Ludo.
He waited, more anxious than he imagined he would be. Janie checked to see how serious he was. In the 6 years since they met, Rob had demanded so little of her, always allowing her to be the driving force in their relationship, that Janie knew the importance of her response.
Okay.
3. June 1985. Despite her prejudices, Janie couldn't help liking Ludo. He seemed disarmingly honest, which may or may not, she thought, serve him well in his chosen profession. As they were half an hour early for their appointment at the Grange, they were in the pub, and Ludo was giving them some background information.
Tom's a retired GP. He's been on his own since his wife died a few years ago, and I'm afraid he's become more and more crotchety and difficult to deal with as time goes by. He and his wife and my parents were great friends once, but he's rather cut himself off now. It's a shame.
Does he live in that house all by himself, then?
Janie asked.
He does, and it's far too much for him, although he has someone to come in and clean once a week, I think.
Janie shook her head.
From what you've said, Ludo, I'm not at all sure he really wants to sell. It's been on the market for ages, and he's even had offers near the asking price in the past, so...
No, he does, believe me.
A quick glance at Rob.
But he's funny about people.
Ludo scratched his head, wondering how to explain.
He won't just sell it to anyone. It has to be someone he likes, and you'll soon know if he likes you.
Rob and Janie exchanged a little skeptical smile. Ludo continued.
Anyway, he seemed in a remarkably jolly mood when I arranged this appointment, so fingers crossed, he still is.
They spent some time looking at the floor plan, and, as Ludo had promised, the house was nowhere near as big as Rob had feared. Janie could feel Rob's excitement. In his head, he was already redesigning the first floor and making plans for the outbuildings even before he'd seen inside. Janie wasn't excited. She was confused and conflicted. She was half hoping that they'd both hate the house, avoiding the need for difficult decisions and compromises. But, on the other hand, she was totally unprepared for the huge emotional pull she'd felt driving down through the familiar villages, a trip she'd avoided for the last 20 years. The worst outcome would be if Rob loved the house, and she didn't. Tom Kelly couldn't rest, and he checked his watch again. He'd opened the gate earlier so that Ludovic could park his ridiculous...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?